This is Abby Wasserman, taking an oral history from Robert Greene on January 23rd, 2019. Bob, tell me a little about your background, where you are from, and when you came to Mill Valley.
Well, I was born in 1941 in Jersey City, New Jersey. My dad was a professional fighter, so we spent a lot of time in the New York area, moving from one apartment to another, you know, wherever he was getting fights.
Was he was a fighter himself, or was he a promoter?
Professional boxer. As a matter of fact, never achieved the acclaim that other people figured that, you know, he would achieve. Forget the boxer's name, but after he retired, he had an athletic column for the New York Post, and he picked my dad to be the next welterweight champ of the world. That never happened. He did have a shot at Tony Zale, who was indeed the welterweight champ of the world, but Zale beat him. At any rate, I went to college on the East Coast, a small school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Dickinson. Right after college, my first job was in college textbook publishing for Rand McNally. I was both a procurement editor and a salesperson for the few books that we did indeed have, working primarily in Texas and Oklahoma. In 1964, joined the Coast Guard because my draft number was up and coming. And after getting demobilized, took the job for Rand McNally here in California and worked UC Berkeley and Stanford, primarily trying to put together writing projects that would serve as college textbooks.
So were you interested in being a professional writer? Was that where you thought you were headed?
No, I had no idea what I was going to do. Just a job that was offered to me. Seemed like a heck of a lot of fun spending your days on a college campus. And then, you know, the job was, it was a good job. I met a lot of interesting people, but I never felt quite equipped intellectually to do it. The people I was talking with were, you know, the very, very well-esteemed within their particular disciplines. And for the most part, I didn't know what they were talking about. But apparently, I did okay. And then after 4 years with that, I took a job with Young & Rubicam, an advertising agency. And that was just wonderful, particularly so since the powers that be in New York decided they were going to close the San Francisco office because all production was being done in L.A. anyway and move us all down there. But as a young guy living in San Francisco, there was no way that I was going to move to Los Angeles. So for the last year, I did everything. I was account liaison. I did the creative, wrote the copy, and did the storyboards. So that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. By 1969, I needed a job, and I kept reading in the newspapers that the Japanese were going hither and yon to acquire, Western European and American contemporary art. Figured, what the hell, I'll pack a sack and go live in the Ginza for a while and see if I could sell anything.
Now, tell me, Bob, were you married by this time, or were you a single man? Did you have a family?
Single guy, yeah. Mm-hmm. I got married in 1972. But anyway, that's how it started. And then, you know, I was doing pretty well, and I was paying what I thought was a lot of money for a studio apartment in San Francisco, $175 a month. And I found that I could buy a home in Marin County, figuring in the mortgage, the taxes, and the insurance, and it would cost me $165. And I was buying a designer spec house in Mill Valley. So I think, how can you beat that? There was no real estate boom. The only people that were, you know, living in the place were older bohemians and younger hippies. Great town. Still wonderfully bucolic.
Tell me a little bit about life in Mill Valley when you first moved here. Where did you shop? What did you do for entertainment?
Well, you know, if we backtrack a little bit, when I arrived at boot camp, as we're driving onto the base, there, standing underneath the American flag, was this rather chubby guy in his underwear, with a watch belt on and a sailor cap, and it turned out that he was a member of the football team, and that they caught him instead of standing his watch properly attired, they caught him standing his watch in exactly the outfit he was wearing underneath the flag. So he and I became friends because I played football as well. He turned up one night in Mill Valley when I first moved in, and he became my Batman. I was making enough money to afford a butler, so he became my butler. He did all my shopping, all my cooking, and all my cleaning.
What was his name?
Ross Pullen. And he eventually, right after working for me, he got a job as the chief chef for the governor of Oregon.
Oh, Bob, that's such an improbable story.
a silly story. But yeah, I mean, I can go in deeper than that, but I'll not mention anything else.
So this was in 1969.
This was 1969, and Ross sort of lived and worked for me until 1971. At this point, I started a little company called The New Art, where we were trying to, you know, sort of push photography forward as a fine art form. There were very few, you know, there was only one photography gallery in the Bay Area that was called the Focus Gallery in San Francisco. But we attacked it from a different angle. Whilst with the advertising company, there was wonderful commercial photography crossing my desk every day. So I knew most of these photographers, and every one of them wanted to do what they would call fine art photography. So we started to publish their work, but not photographically. We did it with offset lithography, and we sold it with point-of-purchase displays out of bookstores, department stores, and interior design shops. And crazily enough, we did beautifully with that. So I made a fair whack of dough doing that. Didn't do it as well as my competitors. You know, when they came on the scene, they did it much better. Hallmark did a program much better than us. There were other big card companies that already had access to the market that did it much better. But, you know, that stage of the game, I made a few dollars and thoroughly enjoyed myself, so I wasn't bothered. And then at the same time, I was taking fine art, paintings, watercolors, and work on paper, original print, to Japan. And so I was getting started in a different direction.
The artists whose watercolors and paintings you took to Japan, could you say a few of those names?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was starting out having no idea really what people were interested in. I knew that it would be very difficult for me to find up-and-coming, emerging painters that the Japanese might, you know, be willing to buy. So I had essentially name-brand work. I brought Picasso drawings, Picasso original etching, Matisse drawings and original lithography. I did work with Sam Francis, so I was bringing work on paper, unique work on paper of his, and Paul Jenkins as well. But I wasn't getting it from them. I was getting it off the secondary market.
Tell me about Sam Francis and Paul Jenkins at that point. Were they both California artists?
Yeah. Sam was born in San Mateo. He was pre-med at Berkeley. The war broke out. He joined the fledgling Army Air Corps as a pilot, crashed his plane, and spent 2 years literally on his stomach at Letterman Hospital. And he used painting as a form of recuperative therapy. So when he was finally able to walk again, although he struggled with those injuries all through his life, he went back to Cal, got a studio arts degree, and because of an intellectual bent, got a master's in fine art history. Sam was the marrying kind, so he married his high school sweetheart, who looked after him whilst he was at
Letterman.
At Letterman, and they were married for about 4 years. He met a gal named Muriel Goodwin, who was from Berkeley and a wonderful painter. And they went off to Paris and spent the decade of the 50s in Paris. I think her name was, his first wife was Ginny Fuller. She loved him all of her life, and he actually looked after her all of his life. And the same was true with Muriel Goodwin. Even though they divorced too, Sam met the heir to the Japanese Idemitsu fortune, banking fortune, married her, but looked after Muriel. Muriel ended her life with Alzheimer's, living in the Redwoods. And I remember she used to come down to the different shows I would do with Frances, and she would talk about how strongly she still felt about him as a human being and as a painter. And I used to go up to the Redwoods and give little talks, sometimes about Frances, sometimes about the flow of contemporary art. And she would always be very thankful for that. And I remember the last time I did that, I finally found two of Muriel Goodwin's paintings that she did whilst in Paris. Unfortunately, she didn't remember who Muriel Goodwin was at that point, nor did she ever remember that she was a painter. But the good thing was the audience knew.
Oh, that must have been very meaningful for them.
Yeah.
How about Paul Jenkins?
Paul, that's another strange story. He was born the same year, the same month, 2 weeks apart from Sam, and they traveled the same path. They were young guys living in Paris, exchanging ideas, exchanging thoughts. And as a matter of fact, the very last Sam Francis print show I did not come from the Francis estate, which was totally sold out, but rather from Paul Jenkins' personal collection of Sam's prints. So they exchanged work throughout their lifetime.
And Paul Jenkins was originally from where?
From Kansas City.
From Kansas City.
Yeah, he joined, I guess, the Merchant Marine during the war, and got demobilized on somewhere on the East Coast. Took advantage of the GI Bill, and went to the, I forget the art school, but it was very prominent in the day, and. You know, the rest is history. He was a painter and a successful painter all of his life. Those are the unusual things about both Sam and Paul. They never had to work a day job. They were painters all of their lives, and each one was extraordinarily successful. Sam would have been a world beater, but he died prematurely in 1994 at 70 years of age. Paul lived on till 89, and was remarkably successful.
Let's talk more in a little while about the other people in your current gallery stable, if stable is the right word.
Probably,
it's,
yeah.
It's kind of an old-fashioned word for the painters or artists that are carried by a gallery.
It almost seems like I was beating them or something.
I know it's
back in the stable.
But let's go back now to the 22 years that you spent selling overseas, traveling a great deal. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming after your marriage.
Yeah.
And tell us also your wife's name, and then a little bit about those 22 years of adventure. You have described them as ridiculously lucrative and a hell of an adventure.
Yeah, I mean, lucrative from the point of view that I did not have to maintain a lease on a bricks and mortar gallery. I did not have to do any of those things. I could buy exactly what I wanted to buy, and the profits were all mine. And it just turned out that no one had ever done anything like that. And to this day, no one's ever done anything like that. There were dealers. that would go, you know, private dealers that would go back into the trade to get the galleries and sell, you know, secondary market work to them. But as far as going and knocking on doors cold of would-be collectors in strange parts of the world, nobody ever did that. And I guess it was because people, they figured people would be, you know, quite frightened. Who is this person? What are they trying to put forth? Just the opposite. Everybody was, you know, particularly in Australia, come on in, we'll throw another shrimp on the Barbie. Come on in, we'll have another, you know, a beer. Because they, everything was, it was before the internet. So there were, you know, where were you going to get news and ideas of what was going on in the rest of the world, particularly the United States, particularly when you're talking about such a small field as fine art or the dissemination of fine art. So, yeah, it was just wonderful. One or two stories that really sort of clarify the success. There was a guy named Joe Henderson. He was a Jungian therapist. He was from here but worked in New York and then finally ended up working here on the West Coast, lived in Ross. And he, Sam Francis, was really interested in Jungian psychiatric or psychological therapies. So they would talk after midnight. Sam and he never met physically, but they had many, many, many phone conversations. But stepping back a little bit, Joe was also the psychiatrist that introduced Jackson Pollock to his demons. Jackson Pollock was tutored by an American regionalist painter, Thomas Hart Benton. So he was painting essentially American regionalist landscape and peoplescape. But when he went to see Henderson, he couldn't talk about his demons. So Joe said, you should draw them. So that was the beginning of his break with realism. It was an introduction to Jackson when he was viewing and drawing his demons of surrealism. But towards the end of these sessions, they started to abstract out. So Henderson really had a significant impact on the flow of Pollock's art. It also got him into deep trouble because in 1968, he did an exhibition of those drawings, which was an affront to the Hippocratic Oath. He should not have been showing that stuff. He did it with Fred Maxwell in San Francisco.
Maxwell Gallery.
Maxwell Galleries. And they were very successful. There were 80 of these drawings, and they sold a big bunch of them. And I fortunately bought two without thinking about reselling them. But when I first turned up to Sydney, the government had allowed funds to be put forth to build the first Australian National Gallery in Canberra. They had yet to break ground, but the director, James Mollison, was already acquiring work, and he bought Pollock's Blue Poles for the princely sum of $3 million. In 1971, I think. And this is the biggest scandal ever to hit Australia in those days. Here they were in the middle of a recession, and here they are spending $3 million for all this slash and dash. I mean, this story was covered in every portion of the newspaper, from the front page to the business section to the entertainment section and on like that. Well, I turned up with my two Pollock drawings, and sure enough, I sold both of them for princely rewards. So that was one thing.
That's so interesting about Joe Henderson, because yeah. I believe he's still living.
No, he's gone now.
Oh, is he gone?
He died at 104. I think it was probably 2005.
Did you know him
pretty
yourself well?
Yeah.
I hear he was a wonderful therapist.
Yeah, he was quite a guy. He called me near the end of his life, and he says, I just got a package. I haven't opened it yet, but it's from this guy, Sam Francis. And Sam had been dead for a while now. And he said, you should come on up to the house. We'll open it together. And I've got a bottle of Glenlivet. And that was the few times I was up there. That's what we were doing, drinking scotch. So I went up there, and it turned out that, put it down?
No, just be careful about your foot tapping.
Okay, yeah, I get a little nerved. But we opened the package, and there was a work on canvas, one of Sam's works on canvas, a mandala, you know, peering into the void, very Jungian. And it was, you know, came from Sam's estate. He bequeathed it as a thank you for all the conversations that he had with Joe.
Wonderful story. Let's now segue into Mill Valley, going kind of, you know, when you must have come home from time to time, or you wouldn't still be married. But
married, yeah.
What is your wife's name? She's from
Britain.
Great Britain.
Yeah. Her name is Pauline Tomlinson, and she flew for many years with Pan American. So oftentimes she'd be on the flights that I was taking down under. And, you know, that's another thing that made it easy, because I was flying discount. Oh, so sorry. I was flying discount. And, you know, that was another way that make it rather inexpensive. And then this is just a little bit of a sidebar. I had met so many people down there that I no longer had to stay in hotels. I always had a place to stay.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. So what, with this very lucrative business going on, what made you decide that you wanted to open a gallery and be in one place?
Yeah, well, by then I knew what I felt the successful gallery scene was all about. You never, ever showed anything that you truly didn't believe in. You started with people that you felt were thoroughly impassioned by the imagery they were making, and you too had to be thoroughly impassioned about that. You never worried about the would-be acquisitor. They would find their way there if you were doing the first two edges of a triangle correctly. And then you'd find, if you talked it up enough, you'd find somebody that either was willing to listen or had a similar sensibility as you did. And that's sort of the way it's played out. And I knew that, I was dealing at this point primarily with work on canvas, which was no longer portable. I could not bring it with me like I did with work on paper. And I was, you know, after 22 years of being on and off aircraft, I was fed up, and I was also very tired because, you know, in the early days in Australia and even some of the places I went to in Latin America, you know, it was all new to me. So I was having a great time looking around as well as, you know, trying to deal fine art. But after a while, I'd get to Australia, I'd hit the runway running, calling people, and for the 3 or 4 weeks that I stayed there, I was seeing 2 or 3 people a day. So I was thoroughly exhausted. I needed to stay home. Now I get jet lag if I go to San Rafael. I don't travel anywhere, certainly not by plane. We did go down to Australia last February with the Queen Elizabeth, but that's the way I travel now.
Bob, who owns the building where your gallery is?
A fellow named George Bennett. He was the pharmacist at Lockwood's Pharmacy. And his family has been buying, I guess, or started buying property in Marin County in the 1930s. So George has been a wonderful landlord to me.
What was the, if I may ask, what was the rent you were paying when you first opened the gallery? And has it gone up very much?
No, he's been really good about that. I think probably, guessing again, about $1,500, $1,600 28 years ago.
What is the square footage of your gallery?
900.
900 square feet.
I guess if you count the bathroom, maybe 1,000.
And the address of the gallery is 154 Throckmorton, correct? And
yes.
That's the only gallery you've been in.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and that was an interesting thing. When I decided to do a gallery, Donna Seeger was working for me. She's always been a good buddy. And she was, you know, was terrific helping me do that thing on Saturday. She was saying, we were talking, she did not want to commute in the city. She had two little young ones that she had to see to. I didn't know what to do. Do you start in the city because that's where the action is? Or do you stay home and avoid the commute? And the truth, that was the smartest decision I ever made because people do indeed find you. So what was the question?
I was a little bit, I was delighted that you brought up Donna because I was going to ask. I know at your 50th anniversary party the other day, you mentioned a special thank you to Donna. And so I was going to ask you about that relationship.
Yeah.
So she was also living in Mill Valley at that time?
She was, yeah.
I see. And with a couple of children. And she, tell me about how she was your assistant.
Yeah, she was dating she was working for one of the galleries on Fisherman's Wharf, which was, you know, she just got out here, I guess, and her marriage had fallen apart. So she needed a job. So she was working there, but she didn't enjoy all that heavy commercial situation. And one of my painters, Mark Erickson, Mark, you know, strange story about Mark or a funny story. He came to the gallery, not to the gallery, but to my home when I was working privately. And he said, what can I do to help earn my tuition at the Art Institute? So he made my frames. He became a good friend. And by the late 80s, I started to be selling his work already. And he and Donna were boyfriend-girlfriend. So that's how I met Donna. And we just became fast friends. She was always so industrious, so good with people. But, you know, I could see that whenever somebody is the boss, particularly in a business where it's defined as art dealing, they always want to deal with the owner because they want to be sure they're getting the very best deal. So even though Donna was more than capable, probably more than capable than me, you know, she did not, she needed to do her own thing. So I always encouraged her to, you know, to get out on your own. You know, she went back into the city for a while and worked for a few galleries on Bush Street. But it was, you know, it was inevitable that she'd be doing her own thing. And she does it so wonderfully well. Plus, she's got a brilliant partner in Suzanne Gray. And Suzanne helped me a lot as well.
You have a good relationship, I think, with artistic women who have been, I know that you have two, I believe you have two, would be Charlotte and Naoko in your gallery at this point?
No, Naoko is a, Charlotte's back after a 10-year stay. She was with me for 10 years. She had a baby and being a mama. And also, I've always encouraged her to be a painter. She's a hell of a painter. As a matter of fact, the first show we did with her, we sold out the first weekend, and that's been true of every show.
And her last name is Bernstrom?
Bernstrom, yeah. Mm-hmm. But she's, you know, the kid's now in school, and she always enjoyed, you know, the dealing part of it. So she's back for one day a week now, which is literally one-third of my week because I'm only open 3 days. And then Naoko is just somebody that I got a call from a New York critic, and he said, you've got to look at this Japanese woman's art. I think you'll really enjoy it, because he had written several articles about her. And I figured, why are you calling me, and why are you suggesting that I go over to Oakland, where the woman is now living, to look at this stuff? And I did, and I couldn't come to grips with it, but I've still kept it. And when there's empty wall space, I hang it, not for the public, but just so I can live with it. And she's a really, really nice person. The biggest problem she has, it's a free flow of pigment, like in the Pollock nature. So people always see that, and that's such a misfortune. Because, you know, this is it's a visual language, and I think I mentioned this the other day, it's with a visual vocabulary. And there are only so many visual words in that vocabulary. So if you can get feeling across by doing that, I'll never deny that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and plus at that point, you know, I wasn't thinking of the next 50. Now I am. So maybe I consider doing something on an individual basis with Naoko.
Tell me, Bob, you said to me before this interview that you had considered closing the gallery after the 50 years. but you decided not to close the gallery and to go for the next 50 after all. Tell me a little about
that
decision.
I'll be 127. the decision was thrust upon me. I was doing a Paul Jenkins show because Suzanne Jenkins calls me one day from Paris and said she was selling their Parisian home. And in the home were 12 paintings that she was not even aware of that dated back to the 1970s. And the imagery was atypical of Paul. They were geometric. And, you know, Paul is known for that free-flowing medium canvas. At any rate, so she says, do you want to show them? So I said, sure. This was in January of 2017. And I had 9 of those paintings, and I sold 7 immediately. Still had 2 up on the wall. And then George Bennett walks in, and he's my landlord, and he says, Bob, there's a bit of a problem. There's some question about the structural integrity of the foundation of the building, and I'm going to have an engineer come in and look at it. Well, sure enough, he said, but, you know, they'll be in and out, no problem. You'll be up and running within 2 weeks. Well, it turned out there was significant wood rot and termite damage. So I was closed for 9 months. Not closed, but everything was plasticized. The entire joint was just one gigantic plastic tunnel. And I'm wondering, you know, what the hell am I doing? Should I continue paying? Well, he wasn't charging me, but I'm still paying for insurance and everything else. But I realized that, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was playing tennis. I was going to movie matinees. My wife and I would take the occasional drive in the countryside, but it wasn't enough. And, you know, I figured I can continue working, and I want to continue working, but I'm not going to do it on a full-time basis anymore. Can you do it in 3 days a week? And I discovered you can.
And how do you do it in 3 days a week, Bob? What, some new techniques that you've developed, or?
Well, I mean, the only new technique is enabling people to look without preconception. You know, when somebody comes in and they ask me a question about a painter, that means they're at least looking. Now I encourage them to look for a while and look at that work in a very humble manner. And maybe it gives you a little tingle. You'd be surprised the number of people that would normally come in through the door, make the roundabout, and they were gone. They had already made a decision that my kid could do this. But in truth, you give them the opportunity to look a little bit, and you introduce them to the fact that this is indeed a communicative language, and this is the truest form, the most courageous form of making an image, because you feel the color you choose. You allow your arm to move freely the way it wants to go. And, you know, these are about all the little minute emotions that are going on in your life without, you know, any thought about a marketplace or anything else. It's just truth and courage. And I try to make people aware of that. And they tend to tell other people. So we're still doing pretty good.
I love what you've said about the process, you know, and how intuitive it is and how individual it is. Tell me, does a gallery owner have to limit the number of artists that he or she represents? And how do you make those limits? Do you have a number, for example, that you know you can represent truly well? How do you do it?
I think there are too many galleries. If you look on, you know, on the internet, there are too many galleries with 30, 40, 50 painters. How can you possibly advance their career? How can how often can you give them a show? If a show lasts a month, you know, the next show is going to be 4 or 5 years down the road. That doesn't work. So what I try to do is make show each exhibition at least 2 months, preferably 3 months, because let's face it, people don't come in the gallery every month. They don't come in the gallery every 3 months. So the people that are coming, this is a brand new exhibition. And, you know, to do it to where you're being fully responsible to each one of your painters, you've got to give them an exhibition about every, at least every 18 months.
And so that means approximately how many artists?
Six, seven, or eight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, now it isn't such a big deal because, as you probably noticed, everybody on the wall is dead.
I have noticed that,
yeah.
Except Charlotte.
Except Charlotte and Mark.
And Mark.
Yeah.
Is Mark a Mill Valley artist, or he...
Mark is now, I'm going to make some noise here a little bit. He lived and works in Oakland, but now he lives and works in Venice as well. His father was a airplane designer for Lockheed Martin, and early on they bought properties with an S in Venice on the canals. So he had those, and that's some of the most desirable real estate in California. And they had a pretty rich portfolio of investments. So at age 64 or 65, whatever it was, he became a multimillionaire overnight. And I guess several years ago, he gets this email from a young woman in the Alps, in the Swiss Alps, who's a painter or starting to be a painter. And she said, "I love your work. I'm coming to California. Could I possibly visit your studio and see it live and in person?" He says, "Sure." And sure enough, they hit it off. And they get married. But the funny thing is, she's 22 and he's 64. But I absolutely love it because I love the direction that his painting is going. All of a sudden, he's gone to a different level stylistically, a different level, image content. So I'm as pleased as punch, and she's just a nice little girl.
You know, Bob, some gallery owners I've talked with in the past they seem to be very conservative. They don't really want their artists to change. They want them to keep on doing what was most commercially successful.
Yeah, it's
How
bad.
Do you deal with this?
I encourage them to go whatever direction they feel they want to go and they need to go, but I tell them that I may not. You know, that may not be for me. There were several people, John McCormick, who Eagle Smith and Ellen's now show, started to do tonal turn-of-a-century landscapes. Prior to that, he did really rich abstraction of a tonal nature. Loved that stuff. Did not appreciate what he was doing with the tonal landscapes, but it wasn't for me. Jim Shea, another guy. Do you remember Jim? He would be on the wall periodically at the gallery. Wonderful architect. Quit his day job, became a full-time painter, did these wonderful rhythmic landscapes of West Marin. They were almost abstracted, but he continued to do them, and he would constantly tell me how much he hated doing them. And I said, "Well, you mean you got to do something different?" And I got tired of hearing that. I encouraged them to do something different, but I always let them know that we may not carry on. Because I've got to believe, like I said earlier, in exactly what you're doing, what you're doing. And one little sidebar, there was a painter, post-World War II painter by the name of Edward Corbett. He was a Renaissance man. He was a poet. He was an author. He was a painter. He was a sculptor. He was everything. Brilliant work. And I sold a few of his paintings, and I had a number of collectors wanting more. So, there was no estate, there was no family, but he lived and died in Provincetown, Rhode Island, Provincetown, Massachusetts. So I figured back in those early days, painters like Sam and Paul Jenkins, they would swap work. So I ran an ad in the Provincetown Times saying, "I'm going to be in town for a week. If there's anybody with Ed Corbett paintings, I'd be very intrigued. I'd be willing to buy them." And sure enough, I got a bunch of old painters turning up with Corbett paintings, and indeed I did buy them. And one of them, one of the old guys, a British guy by the name of Tony Devers. So let me tell you a story, Bob. I was a good buddy with Ed, and I was a good buddy with Mark Rothko. And Rothko and Corbett were the best of friends. And one particular weekend, Mark Rothko comes up to Provincetown, and the three of us are in Ed's studio drinking copious amounts of red wine. But I couldn't keep up with those two guys, so I was gone. And then later on the next week, I read in the newspaper, I heard on the radio that Mark Rothko committed suicide. And one of the topics they were talking about was how pissed off they were or how angry they were with the way the trade was teaching, was dealing with their work. And Frank Lloyd at Marlborough Gallery, who was Rothko's dealer, Rothko was fed up with doing those melting cubes of color. He wanted to go in a different direction, but Frank Lloyd wouldn't let him do that. Finally, Mark, we're selling your work. We need you to paint more. Well, you know, according to Tony, and I've never proved any of this, he committed suicide. And then he realized that he hadn't heard from Ed in a long time. So he goes running up there, and he finds Ed's body. It was almost like they had a suicide pact.
Ye gods.
I don't know if any of that's true, but that was the, you know, that was a way of answering your question.
Well, you know, there was the painter that you were carrying, Dennis Hare.
Yes.
And we had a party for him over at my place in 2003. And I believe that Dennis, his work went into another direction that you were not able to or you did not want to carry. Was that true?
No, not quite. It was not what was true. Dennis was always a good figurative painter, a very, very athletic figurative painter. As a matter of fact, a wonderful athlete. But Dennis was somebody that so many other things in his life took precedence over his responsibilities. And I say responsibilities because I would schedule a show and I would give him 8 months to a year to begin and do the show. But he wouldn't start until 6 weeks before the exhibition, and then he would start putting forth, you know, a super effort. But the work was never as good as it could be. And he was painting with oil, and oil in that little place was lethal. You know, particularly if it was the, you know, 12 months of the year, if the doors are closed and you've got fresh oil paint on the wall, you get dizzy.
This is in Redlands where he had his studio. Was it Redlands?
In down around Redlands, I'm not sure, the little town close by. He never moved from there. He was born in this little town, spent his entire life there. Now he's still a painter, but he's struggling. He's got Parkinson's, and he's got significant heart issues.
And you think that may have something to do with the atmosphere he was painting in all those years?
Yeah. But I don't know that either. But that's very, very strong possibility.
Well, one thing I'm very moved by is the way that you're speaking about that give and take that goes on between the dealer and the artist when they have a close relationship. And so has this fed you in your own, you know, your own feeling of relationship and connection?
I think, you know, what it does, it enables you to have to enhance empathy, you know, like because I needed to know what it felt like, what it is like to be a painter, tried my hand at it. Just, you know, it was an incredible struggle because I was doing something that I didn't essentially need to do or want to do. I just wanted to feel what they felt. So I did a little bit of that. Another little side story, when we went to Washington, D.C. for the Christmas holidays, I said, I'm walking through the mudroom in my daughter's house, and there are two pieces on the wall. I said, man, I had never seen these before. These are terrific. Who did them? And my daughter, Blake, said, come on, Dad, you know who did them. You did those. I didn't even remember, but it was the truth. I didn't remember. Oh. And so I guess it introduces you to empathy, and that follows you in every walk of life. I think I mentioned this to you before, too. I mean, it's a real struggle to make original print. So I went out of my way with George Page, who was Sam's master printer for planography, you know, original lithography. So I spent time with him making lithograph, spent time with Pam Paulson, who was with Crown Point, doing intaglio work. So, you know, you need to know what it's like if you're going to do this. Otherwise, you're, you know, it's just not the way that I see an art dealer's job. An art dealer's job is to give people as much freedom to create and being able to understand the pressures and the efforts that they have to put forth to succeed.
How have visitors to your gallery changed over time, if there has been a change?
The biggest question you've asked. They've changed a lot. You know, just recently, we had somebody come in and look at a masterpiece, Jenkins, a piece from 1968, but a really large canvas. And, you know, they asked me, they said they're, you know, very interested in buying it. What do you want for it? I gave them a price. And we brought it over the house, and they said, man, it looks lovely. Well, you know, just give us a couple of days. Well, of course, what they do is immediately go on the computer and see what, you know, what the work has brought at, you know, sold for at auction, Sotheby's, Christie's, Heritage, all the major houses. So you're always under the gun. You've always got to be within the parameters. They don't understand what the auction world is all about. The auction world used to be the bailiwick of institutions, museums, corporations, and the trade. That's where they would replenish inventory. Maybe there were 10% of those people that were very, very astute collectors. Now, the way it all changed was a man named Alfred Taubman, who was a Detroit real estate developer, built shopping centers all over the globe. Right after he purchased the A&W Root Beer chain, he bought the failing Sotheby Park Bernay from the British. And then looking at a business model, he realized that that's what was happening, exactly what I said, that 70% of the sales went back into the trade, 20% went back into museums and corporate institutions, 10% sold to collectors. But avid, ardent collectors. At the same time this was happening, there was huge bonuses and commissions being paid for leverage buyouts on Wall Street in the mid to late 80s. Man, why don't we go after those guys? So all of a sudden, he was running up the media flagpole every time there was a significant sale at auction. And he was telling people, I realize you're very busy. You have no time to go to museums or galleries. You're working 24/7. But if you come to my auction rooms, all you do need to do is grab a paddle and you win a painting. And you got to remember that after you bought your house in Greenwich, after you bought your second home in the Hamptons, after you bought your yacht, after you bought your nose candy, the last rung on the ladder of affluence is fine art. And then there was all kinds of collusions. And as a matter of fact, Taubman and the CEO of Christie's and the second in command all went to jail.
Wow.
They were colluding. They were colluding with a set of dealers like Leo Castelli, like Mary Boone. They would introduce these painters, people like David Solly, Eric Fischel, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Julian Schnabel. They came on the market not as emerging or beginning painters, not even mid-career painters, but rather people that were selling for five figures. And, you know, Boone would sell this work, Castelli would sell this work, and then they would also, at the same time, tell them, if you ever need to sell it, you could sell it at auction. And all of a sudden, the auction houses would put increased or high estimates on everything. Just to make certain that if it did sell well below estimate, it would still be higher than the retail prices. The whole damn thing was collusion in the Donald Trump terms. And if you, when you look at a work of art, you got to realize, I'm sorry for doing that, you got to realize that an artist is like a human being in any kind of life or profession, like with a baseball player. If he gets 3 hits out of every 10 at-bats, the other 7 are outs, but that's a 300 batting average, and he's an all-star. If a painter makes 3 really good works of art out of every 10 attempts, those 3, that's fine art. The other 7, that's just work. And through the course of their creative life, there's always a period when they're doing that special magic. And with that Jenkins painting, the 1960s were Paul's best years. He was most magic during those years. And, if you look at auction, and if you look at every piece that sold for the last 15 years, you'll see, comparatively speaking, what I'm showing you to this client is the very, very best, far better than any of that. So you just simply can't go by pricing. You've got to go by strength, quality of image. And when the prices really start going up, for Jenkins, then that great work will come out. I won't need to sell it to you. I'll throw it on the lap of Sotheby's, and they'll bring twice as much. Paul was considered the equal with Rothko, Pollock, and de Kooning. And you wonder why they sell for millions and he sells for maybe 100, 200,000 like that, simply because he lived on, was so super successful that people became extraordinarily jealous of him. And so he suffered for that.
So is jealousy a big...
Big time, big thing, yeah.
It's a big thing in the art world.
Yeah, with painters, with dealers.
Tremendously competitive.
Tremendously competitive.
Because there are only a few slots for the superstars. I mean, it's kind of like a crazy selective process that a few dealers do.
Yeah. And it's going to happen where it happened with Joan Mitchell. Back in the late 80s, you can go with a shopping cart and pick up all the work you ever wanted for little or nothing. Finally, they needed fresh blood, and Mitchell got what she deserved. Never while she was alive, but the prices became really big time. Now they're untouchable. With Sam, he died early. He died during a recession from 91 through probably 96 or 7. There was a huge recession. He died in 94. So, the work sort of stopped, appreciating. But now, a good Francis painting is going to bring at auction $7, $8 million. But he was, he lived longer than a lot of those guys. He lived till he was 70. He did a lot of work that was nothing more than Sam Francis loosening his wrist. Should never have seen the light of day. Sam never signed it. It was work on paper. It simply sat in the print cabinets. And, if indeed it was eventually sold, and it was to cover death duties, there was an estate stamp put on the back. But it should never have been sold. So it impacted his market for a long time. But now he finally is getting his fair due. Same with Jenkins. I'm not saying this because I want to make a barrel of money out of it. I'm saying this is the way the market works.
So I did want to ask you about a couple of other Mill Valley people. And I want to be sure to ask you about your interest in music and love of music and the musicians you know here. But let me first ask about Susan Cummins. Did you know Susan well? And
I didn't. We'd have little interactions. I'd go by and look at her work. She would occasionally look at mine. I don't know that she liked me, actually. She came in one day and said, "What are you going to do here?" And I had no idea what she meant. She says, you've got no problem. You've got a little tiny gallery. You can stick anything up. So it was never a nice conversation. But I mean, I respected what she did, and hopefully she respected what I eventually did.
You were certainly doing different things.
She was much more psychological in her choice of imagery.
And more toward fine studio craft.
Indeed, yeah. And the jewelry. I think she told me one time that 50% of her business was with jewelry.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, then on to music.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not terribly interested in super contemporaneous work, but I'm a stage door Johnny. Wherever there's cabaret, I'm out there waiting at the back door, seeing if I could, get an autograph. or I go around and I hire a lot of people to perform at my home.
Oh, you have house concerts?
Yeah.
For example, who has done a house concert?
Oh, I mean, Noah...
Yeah, no, I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah, he's done a number.
You can fill that in the transcript.
Yeah, he's done a number at the house. Certainly Kim Ray. Kim Ray is a wonderful musician, and that little show she puts on, now mind you, nobody can hear her, you know, singing in the back of the room there. But she's just a good writer, a good composer, a good entrepreneurial musician. She brings a different show literally every month to the 142. So I try to encourage her. There's different a cappella groups that I bring by to the house. We had one that did, you know, all of Patsy Cline's, covered all of Patsy Cline's music. You know, for years and years, do it four, five, six times a year. Now with my wife's cancer situation, we haven't been able to do very much. But we'll get back into it.
Noah Griffin.
Noah Griffin, yeah.
That's right.
And Noah was a good friend. I mean, he and I played a lot of tennis together and stuff like that.
Yeah. What advice would you give someone who wanted to open a gallery?
Yeah, boy, that's, it's not like I said, it's not like the old days, but I think if you're going to bother to really, really thoroughly believe in the people you're showing, I would strongly suggest you do it the old-fashioned way. You should not rely on virtual galleries. You should not rely on the computer whatsoever. You need to get yourself out into the community, talk as much as you possibly can, call as many would-be collectors and beg a few minutes of their time. You have to build it up in the same old-fashioned way. You know, now bricks and mortar galleries are going by the boards. They're going by the boards very rapidly in Chelsea. Only the really large galleries like Pace, like Gargosian, like Michael Werner, they're going to remain forever because they've got huge amounts of money. And to go see the superstars, that's where you're going to go. But the bricks and mortar places, they're trying to show the up-and-coming talented people. It's a real struggle. But I think you could save yourself a lot of money if you just show people you truly believe in, try to do one show a month, try to choose your location as best as possible. I think Mill Valley's a terrific town for that. I mean, this is a special place. You've got the Marin Theater Company, you've got 142, you've got the Film Festival, you've got the home of the San Francisco Sound, Sweetwater. You've got some very, very good galleries. You've got Image Flow, you got Donna, you got O'Hanlon. Pretty special. So this is a place where people are still very, very interested. You just got to get them to change their lifestyle. Don't look at their cell phone at your website. Come down to your gallery and look at the work on the wall and engage. But it's not as easy as it once would have been. I mean, if you would have followed what I said 30 years ago, you'd be a multimillionaire.
And I was going to ask you, finally, how has Mill Valley changed in your years here?
Well, I mean, it's when I bought my first house for $34,000, a designer spec house, sold it for just enough to cover real estate commissions. So 2-3 years later, the real estate boom didn't happen till the mid, maybe even late 70s. So that's certainly, all of a sudden, you had to really stretch your budget to buy a home here and live a lifestyle here. There are so many cars on the street. There are so many Italian restaurants. There are just, many, many dress shops. And it wasn't like that. There used to be two pharmacies. There used to be a five and dime. There was Sinapa Farms or whatever it was called and La Ginestra. That was pretty much the sum total when I first moved here. Then I guess El Paseo moved in. Yeah, I mean, life was simple. It ain't simple anymore. And, but it hasn't really changed much. I can moan, but I still love living here.
Now, you sold your first house. Where did you buy? Where did you move?
I moved probably about 1 mile. And then I sold the first house, which was on Erica Road, going out towards Stinson. Then I bought one closer, once again, still in the county, And then finally, the third house I bought, we had just come back from a stomach crawl across France through the Loire Valley, spending a lot of time drinking and eating. And I fell in love with French architecture. And as we're driving, you know, into the junction, I look up on the hill, and there's this ersatz French chateau. Next day, my daughter and I try to find it, but we can't find it. We're going in the area where it should be. It turned out it was on the back end of a fire road. And a guy who was a 747 pilot for American Airlines, who was a frustrated architect, he'd built his own house, was building this place. And it was right during the latter stages, the beginning of Ronald Reagan's presidency, when the interest rates were through the roof, 16-17% to something like that. And this guy wanted $450,000 in 1980 for the damn place. But I figured, what the hell? I love that house. So I bought it, and almost, I was struggling every month to make the mortgage payments. I think that's the way people are tending to live now that are newcomers here. Both husband and wife are working. They might have a little one, so they've got to make provisions for childcare. It's a struggle. They work hard.
So what is the address of the house you live in now?
288 Green Street.
Oh, you got it. They named the street after you.
Well, there was no street sign on there, and I had to build the road. So I figured, what the hell?
Bob, do you have the one daughter, or do you have other kids?
Just one daughter.
And her name is Blake.
Her name is Blake, and I got two granddaughters.
Two granddaughters.
And
yeah.
Two 12-week puppies now.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. This has been very, very interesting. I appreciate your time.
And thank you very much, Abby, for letting me blab.